I wouldn't say it's all semantics, but really talking about some of the theoretical underpinnings that have devalued the lives of oppressed communities worldwide is a very, very important conversation to have.
This is Civios, your source for public affairs research. A podcast from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota.
In this episode, we'll be talking with Dr. Fiola Jacobs. She joined the CREATE initiative at the University of Minnesota as a postdoctoral associate in December 2018. With CREATE, she works with communities of color and low-income communities to document current environmental injustices. In this work, she is focused on producing a more equitable environmental future. Thank you, Fiola, for coming here and talking about your work. In your work around environmental justice and radical urban planning, can you talk about your role as a Black feminist urban planner who researches disasters?
How I came to that identity is a long story, but I grew up in the Caribbean where natural disasters were a part of everyday life, or at least every year life. And so growing up around volcanoes, earthquakes, hurricanes especially, there were always these key moments in which we could understand something different about ourselves. And when I started my master's in urban planning, I sat in on a disasters and climate change class, never thinking that this would be where I would end up, what my professor at the time called the disaster bug. And I was really interested in disasters as this space where we could understand ourselves and also imagine ourselves differently. And I think as a Black feminist, it was important that I bring that into it. But also Black feminism allows us a context for understanding some of the complex systems of oppression that set the landscape to move from having a natural hazard to having a disaster. And I thought that it was an important lens to look at some of these issues through.
In the traditional urban planning around disaster recovery, there's a term that is used a lot called social vulnerability. Can you define that and talk a little bit more about why that felt insufficient to you?
So the term social vulnerability came out of a 1994 book called At Risk that was really trying to evaluate communities' different experiences of disasters. So why is it that poor communities are hit so much harder? Why is it that Black communities and other folk of color tend to experience worse damage during hurricanes and other disasters? And so Blakey and Wisner, two geographers, coined this term social vulnerability, and were really paying attention to the social forces that shape communities' experiences of disasters. So the poverty that meant that people weren't going to have enough money to buy a $200 kit to survive the hurricane, electricity outage, etc. I was really fascinated by the way social vulnerability was used to complicate quantitative analyses of disasters and identify vulnerability hotspots. What I was really uncomfortable with was the ways that social vulnerability did not talk to the underlying forces that created these vulnerabilities. So there was lots of literature about Black people and communities of color experiencing disasters even worse. People without English as a first language really having trouble accessing a lot of materials. And all these things that really seem to equate being poor, being Black, being brown, being a woman with being vulnerable. And I was really, it did not sit well with me, the way those things were spoken about. And so I wanted someone to really speak to how do these communities become more vulnerable in the first place, as opposed to it being an innate characteristic of them as individuals and communities.
So Fiola, clearly language and theory are pretty important, especially when you're dealing with the pressing life and death concerns of disasters such as hurricanes. Can you talk a little bit about any of the pushback that you've had with your emphasis on the semantics and why semantics are important?
Yes, definitely. I get into a lot of these conversations, especially with professional planners who are very interested in really practical tools that they can use now to implement hazard mitigation techniques. So they're not really concerned with what words you're using for these communities or how they got there. The reality is hurricane season is coming every year at around the same time, and it's a few months where people's lives and stability are in danger. I really understand the pressing nature of those concerns, but I also remember this perfect passage in a book called There, There by Tommy Orange, where he speaks about everybody is so concerned about these young children jumping out of windows and they're trying to bar up the windows, and they are not concerned with the fact that the house is on fire. They're not concerned with the fact that people are trying to get out of this for a reason. And I think semantics, and I wouldn't say it's all semantics, but really talking about some of the theoretical underpinnings that have devalued the lives of oppressed communities worldwide is a very, very important conversation to have. And so when I was looking through literature and at social vulnerability studies, there are all these social vulnerability studies. In my literature search, I think I came up with about 300 social vulnerability articles around flooding that use the term race. And when I went and looked for studies that use the term racism, there were two, and one was a fluke because it came up as an article on Disney princesses. And so if we are talking about race and not talking about racism, then we're seeing that the work that we're doing with and for oppressed communities is a favor. You're weaker, so we're helping you out, as opposed to we have made communities more vulnerable and really taking up that work to get at the root underlying causes of vulnerability, which floods present this painful moment for us to really peel back and take a look at.
When we look at disasters and disaster research, what does a Black feminist lens make clear that social vulnerability does not?
In one of the earliest texts about social vulnerability, which was remarkably one of the more critical texts that takes it up, it was like, this is really good work. The social vulnerability work has largely moved away from this, but here is these moments where people are really talking about gender and sexism in real ways. And Wisner and Blakey, in one of their case studies, they're speaking about a moment post-disaster where domestic violence incident reporting goes up. And so in that moment, they explain that it is not the female gender itself that marks vulnerability, but gender in a specific situation. And then say that the cause of the increased domestic violence was the male anxieties and frustrations acted out when working class men lost their jobs. And I think for a lot of people, that would have been enough. For me, it was such an uncomfortable moment because here's this moment where sexism is made clear because everybody is in this really frustrating and difficult moment of trying to get your life back together after a natural disaster. And the lesson becomes frustrated, anxious men hit women, as opposed to there is like this underlying system of devaluing women and this underlying violent system towards women that is made so much more clear in this moment. And what are we going to do about the fact that this is acceptable? So it's just like, ooh, hurricanes make some men angry, as opposed to, I think Black feminism tells us, looking at that case, it's just clearer right now how violent sexism is, and really using that opportunity to start community conversations about what it means to value this entire gender of people so much lower than the men.
Viola, as you've stepped into this space, what are the implications that you see of this paradigm shift for disaster management practitioners and researchers? But more importantly, the communities experiencing oppression who are also vulnerable to flooding disasters. What are the implications for them?
For me, there are some very clear implications, especially when we turn to Black feminism. And I tell people I turn to Black feminism specifically because all of these conversations about equity and race, class, and gender are those three things that we're constantly talking about. There is a space that has been developing words around racism, classism, and sexism for arguably centuries, but definitely for the past 5 decades at least, there has been this strong Black feminist scholarship that has really laid out a framework for understanding the interconnected nature of these systems of oppression, right? And so for me, Black feminism is an obvious place to turn to when we're concerned with race, class, and gender. And so turning to the lesson that Black feminism gives practitioners and researchers is that you don't know. You don't know the questions. You don't know the communities. You don't know anything. And so what we really do need to do is start centering the voices of people living under oppression. So it changes the questions completely. It changes the answers completely because we are acknowledging that we don't even have the framework for understanding this. And so Black feminism speaks a lot more about a dialectical relationship between oppression and activism. By treating this work as care work or charity work, we are robbing oppressed peoples of their agencies to speak for themselves and say some of the concerns and really frame some of that research. And so for researchers, it's completely reframing the questions. It's centering the voices of poor Black women or the most oppressed people within whatever communities you're working within to figure out what are the needs, what are the concerns. And in terms of practitioners, it means a more holistic community engagement, not merely checking off, we sent this email to churches, but really getting into communities and listening to people about their concerns. And for oppressed peoples, they've been, I wouldn't say giving the voice to oppressed peoples, because oppressed peoples have voices, and it's just about us in the academy and in the practice really listening to them and centering them and making plans based on what people need.
You use this framework to conduct a quantitative analysis of the National Flood Insurance Program, for instance. What did you find out? What were some of the results?
I really, really enjoyed thinking through what the Black feminist lens could do for quantitative research. A lot of quantitative researchers are like, sure, like we'll read all this stuff on sociology and groups and et cetera, et cetera. But like, what does that mean for when we have a regression to run? And so thinking through what Black feminism could tell us, I suppose I used the National Flood Insurance Program's community rating system as somewhat of a test case. Like, can it tell us things that social vulnerability does not? What would a quantitative model based on it look like? And so I created a series of quantitative models, one of which was based on social vulnerability. So the National Flood Insurance Program encourages communities to join it, and you have to meet a certain number of hazard mitigation standards in order for a community to join it. And then when your community joins, the individuals and businesses within that community, and by community, I mean municipality or jurisdiction, sorry. When you join the National Flood Insurance Program, then you get access to this federally discounted flood insurance, because most private insurance agencies won't offer it without that federal incentive. And then there's a program which goes even deeper, which is the community rating system. And so then if you implement the Rolls Royces of hazard mitigation standards, then you can get even cheaper flood insurance. So a class 9 community gets 5% discount on their federally backed insurance, whereas a class 1 community gets 45% discount. And I was really curious which communities are able to join this so that the people living within them can get affordable flood insurance. And so I did a general analysis, like putting in some of the things that we think about, like median income. Okay, so richer communities would probably be able to get the resources together to implement all of these very technical hazard mitigation measures. A larger community assumedly would be able to get the resources together easier, more easily than a small community, et cetera, et cetera. And then I said, what would social vulnerability tell us? And so for me, social vulnerability is asking the question then of who's living in the community. So it's just a simple race breakdown with all of those previous variables, but this time we're adding the race, poverty, and gender composition of these communities. And so when I added that, there were a couple cases in which it showed up that some communities of color, the larger the percentage of people of color within the jurisdiction, the less likely they would be to join the CRS and gain higher class standings. So I was like, okay, but it wasn't a very strong finding and it wasn't consistent across a few of the different models I ran. But when I use the Black Feminist Framework, which is not just about a community of color having lower capacity, but this time it is about people being intentionally discriminated against by historical things, I didn't do the work within this particular study of unpacking where that discrimination was coming about, but it was the framework I set up was not just looking at who's in the community, but who's in the community at risk of flooding. So it was a very time-consuming process of mapping all the floodplains on the Gulf and Atlantic coast states and figuring out the racial, ethnic, and poverty compositions of those neighborhoods. And so I looked at these people are at risk and also the intersections of the communities. So I looked at who's living in the floodplains in terms of Black communities, in terms of community people living in poverty, as well as single mother-headed households, and then the intersections of those communities. So does it matter if the household is a household in poverty led by a single mother who is Black or a person of color? And when I did that analysis this time, so much more stuff popped up. It was clear that especially being a person of color in combination with being in poverty or being a female-headed household, when those communities were the ones in the floodplains and at risk, then the municipalities were less likely to join the flood insurance program. So I think that's a heavy concept. Like, there's a lot going on there. The basics is social vulnerability is saying, like, you know, poorer communities of color just aren't joining the community rating system. Whereas Black feminism is asking, like, is it just that or is it that? It depends on who's at risk. So if your floodplains are white and rich, you're going to, as a municipality, run out and do everything that you can to protect this and make sure people living in the floodplain have access to the affordable flood insurance. Whereas if your communities tend to be Blacker, tend to be more female-headed households, tend to be more in poverty and at the intersections of those three communities, then you're like, the planners, the officials are just like, we're in less of a hurry to make sure that we're doing everything we can to protect the floodplains. And so that's what became clear from those analyses.
So the protections that we have put in place are discriminatory as well.
Yes, indeed. And that's what happens with colorblind policies when we pretend that the field is even and we can just ignore race and all of these things, then we implement policies that continue to exacerbate inequities.
So let's talk about that for just a little bit. What are the implications of your research on environmental and disaster policies? You looked at what is, what would be the implications of the research and the findings?
So this is a very difficult question and something I am always struggling with. And it is how to make space for people in these systems that were not designed for the health and wellness and happiness of all, right? So are we making an adjustment, which sometimes policy feels like, to just make a few more people a little bit comfortable? Or are we acknowledging that we need to change the whole system, and what does a changing of the system need to do? I think that at this point, after working with planners and working with disaster agencies, etc., I think one of the first things that needs to be implemented is really listening. I think that there need to be anti-racist critical race scholars who are, or critical race activists, I shouldn't say just scholars, who are in conversation with disaster managers at every point during a project. And so not just thinking as planners, okay, at the end we have this idea, let's go see what community feels like, but really involving community members, especially those who have been disenfranchised at every step during that process. I think that it is all well and good to have an equity committee, etc., whenever there's a problem that comes up at the city level. I think that there need to be continuous departments that are consulted at every step during the process, from the time a question is formulated, an idea for a development is put out there, to really sit and think about some of the implications and ask questions that we as researchers or we as whoever don't know how to ask because we're not a member of the community. And so I think it can, what that honest, real, authentic community engagement and being willing to be led by community can look different based on the exact policy, etc. But I think that deep engagement is definitely needed to move up from token participation to full citizen control.
So when you think about the work that you've done and how it intersects in the disaster policies that are in place, what are your plans to apply this framework going forward?
So I'm really excited about the possibilities for applying this framework. For me, disasters were an important issue because it was a moment that we could really envision something different for our communities, for ourselves, for each other, etc. And I'm really interested in other moments. So right now in Minneapolis, as we're thinking through the Upper Harbor Terminal development project, which is going on in North Minneapolis in close proximity to a lot of historical Black communities and neighborhoods, and thinking through this really great opportunity to develop 50 acres of land, I think like a disaster, it sounds really bad to compare it to a disaster, but really like a disaster, it's a moment where there's rubble, where there's this space that something new can go in, and we can really contend with how to do that in a more equitable fashion. And so I am really interested in thinking about moments like Upper Harbor Terminal and thinking about moments like hurricanes and using them to connect especially Black communities across the African diaspora from the U.S. to the Caribbean and to African nations to really think about what vulnerability in changing environmental times looks like, to think about what reparations look like, and also to feel more connected to each other and realize that we're not struggling alone in these fights against oppression, but we have lots of connected experiences that can use to build strong bonds and help us prepare better for disasters moving forward.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Civios, an initiative of the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. To learn more about this segment, please visit civios.umn.edu.